That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And welcome to Ladies Who London podcast. I'm Emily Dell.
And I'm Alex Lacey, and we're qualified London Blue Badge tourist guides.
Each week we bring to you some of the best bits of London.
We talk about our favourite people, places and events with a bit of information, a lot of laughs and a whole lot of fun.
We can be found on Instagram at Ladies Who London podcast and on our websites, ladieswholondon.com.
Oh, yeah, you're not doing yours anymore. It's down. It's completely down.
Completely down.
And mine, which I've negated for quite some time, alexlacey.com, but it is still there. not even bothering doing your guideemily.com. Ignore it.
Well, I've got a new venture, which is coming.
Oh, here we go. Get rich quick scheme.
There will be another website. but no, Guide Emily is currently down. She's still up and running on Instagram, but for various boring reasons that I won't go into, I had to come away from that website. But anyway, how are you?
I'm well. I can't believe it, these weeks are going past so quickly. I can't believe it's podcast time as well. I feel like it goes up and then 20 seconds later, we're recording the next week. I can't keep up.
It's crazy, isn't it? This time of year, I always feel like we've got so many weeks ahead of Christmas. And, you know, you hear people go, oh, it's only Halloween. We've got ages. Why are people talking about baubles now? And then suddenly it's like, oh, my God, I've got to get the tree up. And then Christmas is here.
I'm still very much militantly nothing Christmas before the 1st of December.
Oh, I'm so not like that. I got these really cute little candy cane Christmas lights.
We're not talking about it, Emily.
Oh my God.
We're not doing it.
Come on.
Although, to be fair, I have been going around today looking at all the Christmas lights, sort of wrecking for Christmas lights tours, but still. Hey ho.
Yes,
how are you,
all
anyway?
Up, isn't it?
It's good.
Well,
it's not all up, it's getting there.
It's not fully up.
We should say that the big one, which is Annabelle's, the private members club, which we probably should do a pod on one week, is in the middle of putting up their Christmas window. Mm-hmm. The Annabelle's is the one that they go all out for Halloween and for Christmas, and it's taking a week. I popped by on, I think, Saturday, maybe. I was with guests, and we popped by and they were just starting, and I said, oh, will it be up by the end of today? And the guy scoffed at me and went, no, end of next week. I was like, oh, all right. And I walked past again today, and there's this amazing big like metalwork structure going up out the front. It's a carousel this year.
Wow.
So hopefully by, what are we today? We're Tuesday today. Hopefully by Friday-ish it will be up, so I'm going to endeavour to have a little rummage around and check it out.
Oh, it's so beautiful, isn't it? I think last year, didn't they have their it was like a gingerbread house.
Yes.
And they had Swarovski kind of
crystals.
Diamonds and crystals.
Yeah.
And
unbelievable the amount they put into it. I mean, it must just cost the earth, but it looks amazing.
Yeah,
I didn't get to see their Halloween one this year. I didn't quite make it there, but
oh, it's like an alien. Oh, no, it wasn't Alien.
It was Clown last year.
Yeah, Clown last year, but Aliens had landed this year.
Yeah. But the Clown one was amazing. This massive, scary clown with this huge open mouth.
For the doorway.
Just this open maw of death or something. Yeah, it was bonkers. But anyway, you're all right, are you?
I'm all groovy, babes. Yeah, I've just been for a swim.
Sorry, the dogs are going mad.
What? Is that just me chatting?
She's just come in the room. What's up?
Oh, my God.
What's the problem? drama. I think there's a fox. I'm sorry, everyone, if you're listening on earphones. I think it's a fox in the back garden and she's not happy. Shut up, Tiggy. Anyway.
Oh, Tiggy.
She's very cute, but
she's a lot more entertaining than what I've got to tell
than me.
You.
Yeah, thanks for that. So apologies for everyone listening on earphones. That was Tiggy, who decided to pay us a visit and tell me very loudly she's not happy with something.
No, she's not. But are you happy? Are you having a good week?
Yeah, mostly. I've got some lovely new friends that I've made. I'm making friends, Mummy. I'm making friends. Yeah, I've got this little co-working space that I go to in Putney, and I've made some really lovely friend humans in there. So yeah, it's quite nice. And
friend humans.
Friend
they
humans.
Are definitely humans.
And also some friend dogs as well. There's a couple of friend dogs in there, which I'm very happy about. So yeah, it's quite nice, and I'm sort of settling into Putney, even though, you know, it's a temporary home, but my house is taking longer than I expected. So
but Putney's lovely.
Putney is
lovely,
nice
place to be.
Absolutely. What news from you? Anything?
Any major news? What's been happening?
Dyed your hair.
I've dyed my hair, yes. So I went all natural, which is a lot of grey. And I was like, I'm ready for this. I can do this. You know, I want to be natural. And then after 2 weeks, I was like, I can't do this anymore.
She's raven-haired, listeners. Raven-haired.
I've got so much lipstick on. It looks like I've been drinking red wine all day. Look very funny. But yes. So, yeah. That's what's been happening. I've dyed my hair.
Exciting lives we lead.
Yeah, I've had some nice work.
It's been bizarrely busy for November, actually, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. It hasn't really calmed down like it usually does for November. No. Usually you get a bit of time to go, you know, before December.
But no, we're still exhausted.
Yeah. But yes, so yeah, you're good. Any news?
No, not really. That's it. Crack on.
Crack on. So, okay. Cool.
So cracking on. End of last week, we were talking about, well, you were talking about lots of historic restaurants in London. And podcast pedestal wise, we had two options. We had Rules Restaurant and the Master Carver at Simpsons. And I genuinely cannot remember which one was my pick.
You never can. It's only been 7 days.
I'm a bear of very little brain.
So you went for the Rules Restaurant.
Oh, did I? Okay. Okay, good. Lovely.
Yeah.
And you went for the MasterCard.
And I went for. I did. Well, it's a bit of a lie, actually, because I didn't. But when I was doing the poll, I was like, this is what I actually choose.
But you knew I wouldn't remember, so it's fine. What did you
but
pick
I've
originally?
Admitted it. I think it was. I know you're going to shout at me because I keep hitting my leg. You're going to be like, oh, stop banging. I can't even remember, but I don't know if you've seen the actual post on our Ladies Who London Instagram. Mm. And we've had quite a few people that have said what they want, option one or option two. Mm. And Jolly Good saying dodgy leather banquet evenings for the win, which wasn't...
It was your banquet, wasn't it? It was the banquet. That was
banquet.
Your...
banquet.
Yeah. In fact, yes, someone has said... yeah, Kieran said rules, although if the dodgy leather banquet had been on offer. So, you know.
I should have put that as the option. But no, I didn't choose banquet. I chose the, do you know what it was? It was the silver platter.
I thought that might have gotten you.
It was the silver platter. And I don't think I knew exactly how to word it. So I went, do you know what? I'm just going to go for the Master Carver.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, remind me what the scores on the doors are at the moment. What's the... I think we're pretty even Stevens, aren't we?
That was one of my little tasks for this week, to try and work out where we are. I'm pretty sure you're winning, but not by you know, mountains. But
well, this week
I'm going to work that out for the next week.
This week I'm winning by another one.
I thought you would be.
55% to 45%. So pretty close.
Okay, so pretty close, actually.
Pretty close. Yeah.
Pretty
not bad, not bad.
Close.
Not but bad. You know, it's got to go rules, hasn't it? It's got to go rules with its fancy pants.
Maybe.
You know,
it is a beautiful restaurant.
It is really nice.
Yeah, and I think you agree. The photo that I used just makes it look absolutely sublime.
It does. It does. I mean, your dude in the chef's hat with the cloche. Also, very nice indeed.
Yeah, yeah. But still.
Hooray!
So, what are we doing this week, Alex?
Well, this week we're going from the posh and the upper crust to the sort of pie crust. Is that a good is that a good link? Well, not really pie crust, but the people at the bottom who barely had a pie crust amongst them. That's what we're going to go for. Very, okay. Very tenuous. We are going up to, so we landed in Shoreditch, which is an area that I love. I love it for a variety of reasons. I love doing the street art around there. I love the history of the immigration and all the different people that have graced the area. I love doing the food tours up there, which all linked to immigration and the people that were there and how people ate when they were in this very, very poor area of London. And I love the vibe. It's London for the Londoners. And so there's a little spot that I really like, and partly because it's really lovely today. It's very calm, it's very relaxed, but the history behind it really belies that. So it's completely different from what it used to be. And this is a place called Arnold Circus, and it's up, if you were coming into Shoreditch High Street Station, you come out of the station, you turn left, you're on the main road there. If you cross straight on over and keep going up about 5 minutes, you come to this absolutely beautiful circular area with a raised section in the middle with a bandstand on top and beautiful red brick, what we'd sort of describe as old mansion houses, that kind of thing. Not, I don't mean mansions in the way of big country houses, but the way that London used to describe these big multi-tenemented buildings as mansion houses. And they go in a circle around it. There's a school on one side, little streets with boutiques and fancy little restaurants that go off the other side. And it's really, really pretty. It's a gorgeous little spot. However, hasn't always been this way. And I wanted to talk about Arnold Circus and a thing called the Child of the Jago. Have you heard of the Child of the Jago before?
I haven't, no. It sounds like a fantastic title to a great book.
It is a great book. And some people might go, oh, I've seen that name before. If you have been along, what's the name of the street? Not Shaftesbury Avenue. The street with all the bookshops on, coming up from Trafalgar Square, Charing Cross Road. Thank you, yeah. Brain. So as it almost meets Shaftesbury Avenue, there is a shop there called Child of the Jago. No relation to the book at all, apart from the fact they've taken the name from it. So don't get mixed up by that. It's a very kind of offbeat fashion shop. Stuff in there is really lovely, but it's not quite linked to the book. So this book we'll come to shortly, but I want to set the scene first. I want to set the scene of the East End of London back in the 1800s, which, as I'm sure most people will know, was a very, very poor area. In fact, one of the poorest areas, not just of the city, but sometimes of the entire country as well. And there's a variety of reasons for this. You're near the docks, so it's a transient population often, or people who jump ship and work their way out. I think we've talked about things like this before.
Yeah.
You know, that thing of making a new life and waves of immigration who come in and gradually get richer and leave and assimilate into London as a whole. There's a system of copyhold, which is an old medieval system, which is essentially it's the whole freehold and leasehold thing, where you don't really own the ground that you're house or building might sit on. So a lot of people don't really develop that land because there's no point. If it's on a short lease, you're going to lose the land at some point. Why bother putting loads of money into developing things? You've got all sorts of industries that are pretty smelly, things like tanning and fulling, which are all outside of the city of London. The city with a capital C, city, they don't want to know any of this grim stuff. They're not bothered. They don't want any of the nasty things. They want everything can go outside. And so the East End, a lot of it goes out to there. It's downwind, so all of your posh houses in the west, the coal fires will chuck out all the grot. It will get picked up by the wind and dumped unceremoniously in the East End. You've got the lower paid industries working in the docks and the industries that go around that. So it's, you know, there's a whole variety of things that go into this kind of pot of the area that is Shoreditch, Spitalfields and the East End globally, as an area. And into this, we need to look at a little bit of some of the details of this area. we have a lot of people in this area who are incredibly poor, so poor that it's even worse than hand to mouth living. You know, it's the case of if you don't earn that morning, you do not eat that night. There's all sorts of different trades in that area, and in particular the area that we're talking about didn't used to be known as the Arnold Circus or the Boundary Estate as it is now. It was known as a slum called Old Nickel. Now, if we sort of look at some of the ways that people were living in that area, I mean, this area was incredibly poor. The death rate is twice as high as other local areas in the East End, four times the rest of that in the rest of London. 25% of children die before their first birthday in this area. It's pretty hideous. You can have a single house with 60 people in it. Yeah. No, there's obviously no indoor running water, so the streets are filled with, well, unmentionable stuff, human excrement and all this sort of thing. And it's a pretty awful place to go. A maze of dark alleys where the sun never reaches. And it's just pretty, pretty hideous. And one of the things that you find in these areas are ways of living and sleeping for people who don't have any other options. Have you heard of doss houses before?
I have, yes.
What do you know about them?
They're essentially places where you would pay a little bit of money, you know, a couple of pennies in the 19th century, and you would get a place to sleep, but you'll probably be sharing the room with other people. You know, they're not very nice. They're kind of the lowest form of paying to stay somewhere.
Yeah. And in fact, not even really sharing a room with a couple of people. Sometimes these rooms are really massive rooms with loads of people, and some of the poorest, there were ways that you could sleep which, well, you could try and sleep. There's one called the penny sit-up. Now, this is sort of as the name would suggest, you pay a penny, and what you have is a series of, I mean, to look at a picture of it, and we'll maybe try and put some on the Instagram this week, it almost looks like a classroom. There are people sitting at desks with wooden chairs that you're sitting on, and you can pay to basically sit there on a bench all night in the hall. Now, realistically, you ain't going to be able to sleep particularly well. You're not allowed to kind of lie down on them or slump over. You're paying for a roof over your head, and you're not really paying for the right to sleep. They're not heated, these rooms. You're not getting any food or anything like that. It's literally a roof over your head. And it's marginally better than being on the street. You don't get that many women there. You do get some, but it's mostly men that tend to go there. Have you heard of the two-penny hangover?
Yes, this is where you are sleeping over a piece of rope, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we'll put some pictures up. Oh, the fox is back, I think. You'd have a rope that went, well, several ropes that went across the room, quite big, thick ropes. And for 2p... you could, shush, hang on. I'm back. Sorry about that. So what were we talking about? Two penny hangovers. Yes. So these were where you paid, obviously, 2p. And these massive ropes would be stretched across the room and fixed on either side. And you could then sit or sometimes even stand and hang over the rope and try and get whatever sleep you could at that point. So it's marginally better. And what they would tend to do at about 5 or 6 in the morning, so that, you know, you get your money's worth but no more, they would either cut the rope or untie the rope, so you could have all unceremoniously dumped in a heap on the floor. And again, these places aren't heated. It was not uncommon to find that somebody had frozen to death during the night, in particular in the harsh winter. So again, not particularly brilliant. The best option, unless you could afford for, you know, your own room somewhere, which if you could, you wouldn't be going to these doss houses, was what were known as the coffins. Now, these are slightly creepy. These are, well, they look like coffins. They are wooden boxes all side by side in this massive room. And they were mostly offered by the Salvation Army, who were the first people to realise that actually some help was needed, and you'd be allowed to lie down in one of these, and they could be maybe 4 or 5p depending on where you were going. You'd be given an oil cloth which you could pull over as a sort of duvet of some description. You might even get a cup of tea, a bowl of soup, a chunk of bread, something like that. So you might even get a little bit of food with that too, but you can tell it's pretty awful. So these are the kind of ways that people are living in this area. And there's a chap that comes into the East End in the 1880s, a guy called Charles Booth. I'm sure you've heard of Charles Booth before. What might he be famous for?
Well, he's famous for the Salvation Army.
No, that's the other one. That's William Booth.
Who am I thinking of? William Booth. Oh, Charles Booth.
He's the poverty map guy.
Oh,
the other one.
Of course he is. Booth's Maps.
Absolutely. So in 1889, Charles Booth publishes a really comprehensive map of London. You can find them online, and they are, I don't know about you, I love maps. I find you can tell so much. You look at a map and it's all there for you. And what he did is he had realised that, you know, life was pretty hideous for a lot of people in London. And he was looking at the extremes between the really rich and the really poor. And he thought to himself, I'm going to go on a kind of campaign to sort of draw light to that. And he basically spent quite a number of years essentially walking through the streets of London and talking to people and finding out what the poverty was, literally street by street. And he then color coded them all on this huge, huge map. And they are so descriptive. It's unbelievable. He did this himself. He wasn't paid to do it. He you know, nobody went, oh, we need this. Go and have a look and we'll pay you for it. None of that. He thought, I'm going to do this. And there were seven different classifications. It went from quite a sort of bright yellowy gold, which is often in the west of London, which was upper middle class, upper classes, wealthy. Then you went for sort of your reds and oranges, which are well-to-do, middle class, fairly comfortable. On we go until you get to the dark blue and the black, which now the black is listed as the lowest class, vicious and semi-criminal. And in this area of London, old nickel slums and the streets around there, this whole area is just a swathe of black. These sunless alleyways, tiny little mazes of streets which are filled with people. You know, these are places that the police were too scared to go down alone. So they'd have to go down in groups and, you know, it's pretty awful. And so when this is published, this is quite a big deal. And people start looking at it and going, oh, my goodness, this is, you know, really seeing very starkly that difference between the rich and the poor. I think we've spoken quite a lot and we've talked about quite a few Victorian philanthropists who pop up in the 1800s and go, oh, well, more towards the latter part and go, oh, let's do things. And they're often very well-meaning. Not always the most kind of well, I guess, aimed or visioned, I suppose, is a way of putting it, would you say?
Yeah.
They want to do stuff, but they just don't always know how to do it. So talking about old nickel in particular, now there's a lot of trades in the area. There are tailors, shoemakers, weavers, carpenters, costermongers, all sorts of things. And there was one report that in 1844 that said, and I quote, conditions were far worse than in a northern industrial parish, that population density was 8.6 people to a small house, and that there were 1,400 houses in an area less than 400 yards square.
Gosh.
Or 370 metres square, which is about equal. So that is an awful lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine them just crammed in cheek by jowl. And it only gets worse over the coming years. There was an author, a guy called Henry Mayhew, who visited in 1850. And I want to read you what he said about it. And this is wonderfully kind of poetic, but it gives you a sense of what it was like. Roads were unmade, often mere alleys, houses small and without foundations, subdivided and often around unpaved courts. An almost total lack of drainage and sewerage was made worse by the ponds formed by the excavation of brick earth. Pigs and cows in backyards, noxious trades like boiling tripe, melting tallow or preparing cat's meat, and slaughterhouses, dust heaps, and lakes of putrefying night soil added to the filth. Now, people might remember from a couple of weeks ago, the week that you were unfortunately not able to join us, Emily, we did talk with Fiona about night soil. Basically, it's the poo, it's the, you know, the sort of
yes,
the latrines, if you like.
It just makes you think, like, it's understandable that people are willing to pay money to sleep on a bit of rope rather than be outside.
Yeah.
It's it just goes to show you how terrible it would have been out on the streets.
Absolutely.
That they're prepared to do that.
And it just gets worse and worse and worse. So as it gets closer towards the end of the 1800s, this place just, you know, it becomes crazy. And so this is a Victorian slum, and it starts to get called in about the 1860s, called a rookery. And a rookery is a Victorian term for kind of for a slum, called a rookery because they see people sort of perched, you know, on doorsteps and places, all kind of side by side, like rooks in a rookery, really. And often it's linked with criminality, with prostitution, with, you know, all sorts of poverty and thievery and all that kind of thing. And there was a book that was brought out in 2008 by a lady called Sarah Wise, and it's called The Blackest Streets. And I want to just read you a little bit of it because it tells you, gives you a real sense. So sort of adding on to what we've heard from Henry Mayhew. And it says, the streets were so narrow that people had to turn sideways and move crab-like along. It was also a criminal enclave, with its strange geography assisting a street robber or sneak thief in his dash to safety. A two-roomed tenement in Anne's Place, a little court off the western edge of Boundary Street, is described as walls running with damp, and the meagre fire burning in the grate has drawn some of the moisture out of the plaster, creating a small local fog. This is home to a married couple with six children. There's no bed, and when you ask them how they sleep, the wife replies, "Oh, we sleep about the room how we can." Gosh. Walk through a hole in the wall into the second room, and you'll see the husband and two adolescent sons making uppers for boots. They're so busy they don't even look up or gesture. They're haggard and hollow-cheeked. So you get a sense of what it's like. And she mentions this, the moisture in the plaster. There was we talked briefly at the start about the land lease thing. Mm-hmm. So you get builders who are kind of going to do it on the cheap and half-ass it a little bit, because the guys who own the land don't really care what happens to it or what goes on it, as long as they're making money from it. Another little quote that she's put in this book about the actual stuff that they use. Instead of using traditional mortar, the speculative builders found a cheaper lime-based substance derived from the byproducts of soap making. This, in bracket or in quotation marks, cement, was known as Billy Sweet and quickly became infamous for never thoroughly drying out and so leading to sagging, unstable walls.
Oh, God.
I know. So if you imagine, these houses, often a lot of them don't have foundations. Mm. You've got this really soggy sort of faux cement that's used as kind of mortar. You're going to get walls that are sagging in, roofs that are collapsing in as well, rotting plasterwork, and any of the wood that's in there is going to start rotting from the damp. And so you've got this house that is basically entirely soggy or mouldy the entire time, which is just not, I mean, yeah, it's pretty hideous.
What did you call it? Billy
Sweet.
Billy Sweet. I haven't heard that before. Billy Sweet. Wow.
Now, what happens is after your man Booth publishes his poverty maps, you know, people start to think about this, and the old Nickel Slum is really very much at the heart of all of this. There is a chap called Arthur Morrison who decides he's going to come and have a little look at the old Nickel Slum. Well, in fact, he's sort of invited. There's a guy who moves in the 1880s who is a local priest, and he invites Arthur Morrison to come and have a little look. And he says, look, you know, I really think you should come and have a look at this. This is the Reverend Osborne Jay, his name is, of Holy Trinity Church. And he goes, come and have a look. It's really bad. The poverty is extreme. You've seen this map that's been produced, and you know, you're an author, maybe you can help. And Arthur Morrison visits the old Nickel Slum, and then what he does is he goes away and he writes a book. This is the book called The Child of the Jago. Mm-hmm. It's published in 1896. Now, ironically, by this point, by the time the book is actually published, slum clearance has already started and demolition has already started to take place in the old Nickel Slum. But the book is really helpful in getting people to realise the problem in these slums. So in 1896 it comes out, and he has fictionalised Old Nickel, and he's called it instead hang about, I've forgotten what he's called it. it'll come back to me. Old Jago, yeah. So the name Old Jago is what he calls it. And I say it's fictionalized. He's not really bothered covering it up too much. In fact, he still uses some of the same street names and things like that. And the whole story revolves around this little boy called Dickie Perrott. And the whole story basically starts from Dickie Perrott as a really young little boy, kind of innocent of the world, who is living in this area. And it details his corruption from being a very innocent, decent small child into a violent, criminal little boy. And it talks about violence, poverty, neglect, and it really shocks people. So I just want to read you the very start of the book. The whole book opens on a really hot summer's night. It's just after midnight. They talk about lots of the residents being likened to, they're likened to great rats running around, and they're preferring to sleep in the street rather than in the houses because it's so oppressively hot. It also talks about a man who's lured into a house by a woman. He's then brutally kind of coshed over the head. He's robbed and dragged into the street where people kind of, you know, loot him and take off all his, you know, take his clothes and steal them. And then Dickie Perrott, this little boy is about 8, is making his way home. He finds his mother and his poor little baby sister with nothing to eat. And as dawn breaks over this monstrously hot place, his father returns with a club in his hand, which is covered in blood and hair. So it suggests that he's also been involved in another robbery somewhere. And this is just the whole kind of standard. So I'm just going to read you the first paragraph or two of this book, which doesn't go into any of the violence, but just sort of puts the whole thing into context. So ready for my dramatic reading?
Oh, so, please.
It was past the mid of a summer night in the Old Jago. The narrow street was all the blacker for the lurid sky, for there was a fire in the farther part of Shoreditch, and the welkin, which is another word for the sky, the welkin was an infernal coppery glare. Below the hot, heavy air lay a rank oppression on the contorted forms of those who made for sleep on the pavement, and in it, and through it all, there rose from the foul earth and the grimed walls a close mingled stink, the odour of the Jago. From where, off Shoreditch High Street, so you see he's not really kind of sugarcoating this, he's telling you exactly where it is.
Yeah, yeah.
A narrow passage set across with posts gave menacing entrance on one end of Old Jago Street, to where the other end lost itself in the black beyond Jago Row. From where Jago Row began south at Meakin Street, to where it ended north at Honey Lane, there the Jago, for 100 years, the blackest pit in London, lay and festered. And halfway along Old Jago Street, a narrow archway gave upon Jago Court the blackest hole in all that pit. A square of 250 yards or less, that was all there was of the Jago. But in that square, the human population swarmed in thousands.
Oh my,
so that's the opening two paragraphs of this book. So you
To read this. I need to find out what happens to Dickie Perrott.
Yeah. Spoiler, it's not good. I'm for that very reason, I did sort of toy with the idea of talking through the plot a little bit, but I'm quite up for reading the whole thing. I've read a synopsis and I don't want to spoil it for people. So we've given you a few books along the way on this podcast, but I think that would be one that, you know, might be quite good to go and see.
Yeah.
So Arthur Morrison, very much, he actually says outrightly that when he writes this book, The Child of the Jago, he wants to show this corruption of this boy who, to all intents and purposes, is an innocent young boy who could have achieved so much by very virtue of where he's born and where he grows up. And no matter what good things he wants to do, whatever, you know, possibilities he's got, his destiny is sort of written large in the Jago, and he can't really escape it. That's his destiny, that's his end, whether he wants to or not. This book caused quite a stir. It definitely caused a lot of shock in the probably middle class communities, who were really shocked about, oh my goodness, this sounds terrible, we didn't realize it was this bad. And a few literary critics get their knickers in a twist, and he said that a few say, oh, you're exaggerating it, and you're exaggerating the viciousness, and it's not that bad, and all this kind of thing. And Arthur Morrison says, I've seen it, I've been there, I've done it. And there's a very famous book that was written in 1902 by Jack London, and it's called People of the Abyss. And it's written by Jack London talking about his experience. He went to the East End of London. He apparently spent several weeks living in the Whitechapel area. So not quite where the old Nichols slum was. By this point, it has actually gone, but not too far away. And he lives with a family. He sleeps in workhouses. He does a whole variety of different ways of living. And he writes The People of the Abyss. And apparently he was inspired to go and do that from The Child of the Jago. He read that and went, I've got to go and see this myself. And so he went there. In turn, Jack London's book then inspired George Orwell's book Down and Out in London and Paris.
Oh, really?
So there's quite a lot of, you know, knock on. So it's clearly working. He's written this book, yeah. And everyone's gone, actually, that sounds, you know, quite intense. So let's go and have a look. Now, this old Nichols slum, it is decided that, well, the Victorian authorities such as they are, there's a new organisation that starts up called the London County Council, which, you know, now is very much what's been, it's morphed into different things, but of course it's been around for a long time, or the LCC as it's known. They decide that, okay, we need to start clearing some of these worst slums, and we're going to start with Old Nichol. We're going to start with that, and we're going to create a new, in fact, the world's oldest, world's first, I should say, in this case, council estate. It's known as the Boundary Estate or Arnold Circus, which is the lovely circular spot that I mentioned at the very start. And it's very, very unique. Now, this was going to be their flagship development. It's, as I mentioned, this circular spot with these beautiful kind of curved lines and just gorgeous houses. In the centre point, you have the actual Arnold Circus bit, which is realistically the middle bit of it. And it's a kind of community garden. And it is this big sort of raised up, clearly man-made sort of hillock on the top of which is a bandstand, which is actually grade two listed. And as are some of the buildings around now. And that hillock contains the remains of old Nichols slum. So it never went anywhere. And as they knocked it down, they decided, well, let's just get all of that rubble. We'll dump it in the middle and we will make this man-made hill so that people can have this garden, this bandstand. It's a really lovely spot to go and sit, and there's trees everywhere and you can just hear the birds tweeting. It's very, very relaxed and chilled. Yeah. And it's quite weird to think that slummy, you know, existence with possibly that billy suite and all those crumbly walls is now underneath that circus in the middle.
I didn't realise that they used what was there before to create the mound.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not maybe all of it, because I suspect there would have been quite a lot of rubble, still.
Yeah.
And so what they did is they decided, designed, can't even talk now, they designed these blocks, which contained, each block contained about 10, well, between 10 and 80 tenements in each one. So they're all different sizes, and the actual apartments are different sizes. It could house a total of just over 1,000 tenements, which then could in turn house about 5,500 people. So you're looking at sort of 5 to 6 per tenement. And this flagship project. That was a big yawn, Emily.
I'm so sorry, did you see that?
We heard it.
I'm so sorry.
Thrilling,
we are
isn't
recording
it?
This quite late. It's not because you're not.
It's 9:30, Grandma. Come on.
No, I've got half an hour until I should have my nightcap on.
Until you turn into a pumpkin. Anyway, if you don't mind.
No, please carry on.
So what was I saying about it being a flagship? So yeah, it was this flagship one. So the whole point was that they were creating this, they were supposed to be setting a new standard for how they wanted people to live. And there was a new laundry, there were shops, there were workshops, there were churches, there were a couple of schools. And the old Nichol was demolished in the 1892-93, and then this started to be built in 1893. So by the time The Child of the Jago comes out, this is already well underway. And it was so successful in terms of, you know, a building project that the Prince of Wales himself opened the estate in 1900. And he actually referenced Child of the Jago in his opening speech. He said, you know, if you've read this book, you won't forget this spot. And we know what happened here and what went on here. And so we're thrilled that look at this amazing estate, these huge, big, lovely buildings. And that the Child of the Jago is behind us. However, not quite as easy as that, because when they formed these new buildings, of course, they were a lot nicer. The new blocks could house, I mean, I said about 5,500 people. That was a significantly less than the number of people that used to live there. And the rents went up quite considerably. In fact, they quadrupled the rent. So the whole point was to be able to house these people from this slum in nicer accommodation, healthier stuff, you know, not just getting rid of all this slum stuff. But actually, realistically, they couldn't afford that. They couldn't afford it at all.
Where did they move them to?
Well, they didn't really move them so much as the people just sort of got pushed out, really. Oh. And they went further out to sort of Bethnal Green Way and kind of Dalston and places like that, which now, of course, again, pretty sheeshy. But back then, it was the next sort of wave of, you know, just push them out. It's that classic thing of, we don't want this here, so we're going to make it nicer, but we're not that bothered about what happens to the people. Mm. So that's what I mean about the Victorians having this sense of, we've got to make it better, but not thinking through all the consequences of it.
Yeah.
So, interesting. So who does come and move in? Well, this is where we start to see one of our big waves of immigration. Lots of Jewish people came in to live here. And in the 1870s, they start coming in and, you know, as they come in greater numbers, suddenly there's all these places and they take over this area. And there's, you know, the entire area, pretty much they say 90% of the children who are raised in that area are raised with Yiddish as their first language. The school is a little school that still exists as a school called Virginia Primary. In 1900, yeah, 90% of the kids there spoke Yiddish. Today, however, of course, the East End has changed quite considerably and the Jewish community has more or less moved to different areas of London and assimilated more into London as a whole. And the following wave was Bengali, as we've spoken about before. Mm-hmm. So today, about 70% of the children there speak Bengali as a first language. And now, because of the laws that were passed in the 1980s, allowing people to be able to buy their council houses, it's about 50% privately owned now. And there's probably around 1,500 people that live and work in the Boundary Estate. So from those numbers, if you imagine 5 to 6 people per tenement, of course, we live quite differently now. We don't tend to live with multiple generations. A lot of people live on their own, so numbers in those houses have gone down. It is an absolutely beautiful spot, though, and I highly recommend, if you're in the area, if you're doing some street art or Brick Lane Market on a Sunday, just take a little tootle up there. You'll be surprised. Within 5 minutes, it's very, very different. And I decided I would go rummaging on Zoopla. I wanted to find out what cost is.
Because they are beautiful, beautiful homes.
They are. So I did find a flat that had been sold in 2021. It was a 2-bed flat, 74 square metres, on Arden Circus. If you go into the little side roads, they are marginally cheaper, but I wanted to see what one was like on the actual circus.
Yeah.
It was $622,000.
Oh, I thought it would have been more.
Well, that's nearly 750,000 for a 2-bed flat.
It is. But in that area, I mean, when you walk around Shoreditch now, you know, it's so hard to believe of everything that you've just told us in the way that how people lived. So, and, you know, it's got so many amenities in terms of being close to central London and Liverpool yep. Street Station, that under 700 in London, in that area, is, you know,
God, we've been so
horrible to say. That's not as
we've been so conditioned to London prices. We're like, oh, it's under $1 million. That's cheap.
I know. Absolutely terrible. How can anyone live anywhere?
But if you know, if you think nearly 750,000, and if you rewind 100 years, it would have been, you know, social housing, and you would have been charged an awful lot less. You know, very, very little for that. It's unbelievable, really.
It really is. And it is such a pretty place. And I've walked through in the summertime and there's been like different people singing under the bandstand, and it's quite a peaceful place, isn't it?
It's lovely. I absolutely love it. It's a really gorgeous spot. And so often, if I'm in the area and I've got some time to kill, I will just go and sit there and read a book, or, you know, just chill and listen to the birds. And so I
and remember how it used to be, because far from what it is now.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So there we go. That is the Arnold Circus Boundary Estate and Child of the Jago.
Mm.
So when you see that shop next time, you'll know.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a couple of photos of the houses, and they really are just so beautiful. It's kind of got that oh, what's that thing on TV called? Call the Midwife.
Teletubbies? Oh, Met Call the
I do watch that nowadays, unfortunately. Fortunately, that has worked into my world. But yeah, Call the Midwife. It's got that kind of like, old terracotta brick, big doors.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's
There's a
lovely.
arts and crafts style, if anyone's
They are
familiar with arts and crafts,
checkerboard
that's your,
print on top of the
yeah.
doors.
It's really lovely.
Yeah.
So there we
Wow.
go.
Gosh, thank you, Alex. Well, I didn't really know how bad it was around there.
I
I mean,
know.
I
I
know
mean,
obviously Spitalfields is so well known for being terrible slums, but the way that you described that area was yeah,
it's quite a
very
lot, isn't it, when
shocking.
you think about it? And I really do want to read this book now and get a
Do.
grip on it and
What
really
happened to
listen.
Dickie?
Do you want me to tell you?
No, I
I'll tell you
don't.
not. I'll tell you not on the recording because I don't want to ruin it for
Yeah, no, I
people.
want to discover what happened to Dickie myself.
Podcast Pedestal.
So, podcast pedestal.
Yes.
Know what you're going to go for?
I do, but I'm going to let you choose first because it's your week.
Okay. I think I'm, and this is someone that I'm a big fan of, and it's one of my favourite things to talk about on tours in this area. I am going to go for Charles Booth's Poverty Map.
Good one.
Because I love it, and we will put some pictures up. If you go to, well, it's about to close, so hurry up or wait until it opens again. The Museum of London, they have a whole section on Charles Booth's Poverty Map, and it's actually just as a piece, it's very beautiful. You can look at it online. You can go on this website, and you can sort of zoom in and find, your street in London and what was the wealth like and all that kind of thing. But it's really it puts into stark relief that the divide between rich and poor. And I mean, what an amazing thing for him to do, going, this needs looking at. I'm just going to devote my time to doing this. Yeah, that's it really. So he's.
Absolutely. He must have spoke to so many different people and
Oh yeah.
been such an observer.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been amazing. And the things he would have seen, and probably a couple of little dangerous spots he might have been into as well.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, okay. Well, that's a very, very good one,
What are you going
Charlie
for?
Booth. I think I'm gonna have to go for the Twopenny Hangover because I think that really demonstrates how terrible it was to be outside in this part of London, that you were willing to put yourself through such a horrible night's sleep. And as you say, they cut the rope and they bang their head. And you'd probably be in there with all sorts of crazy people that probably had a little bit too much to drink, and you're next to them on the rope and they're
Yeah.
not shutting up, or they keep moving, or
No, exactly.
yeah, so I think
I
I'm
think
gonna
the
have to go
Twopenny
for
Hangover,
that.
it's such a visual
It is.
thing. It's you look at it, and when you look at the pictures of it, there are a few pictures online, actual photos, and a few sketches as well, obviously. And you look at it and you go, oh my God, and you can see in their faces, you just think, you've not had an easy time, have you? And now you're
No.
sitting here trying to, hang over a rope to get some sleep so that you don't end up, sleeping on the street and getting a knife in your ribs or whatever. It's
Yeah. And it must have been because, obviously when you fall asleep, you put all of your weight into wherever you are, laying or standing or whatever. So all of the weight must have gone towards the rope, and they must have got, some serious kind of burn
Oh
marks
yeah.
under their
Could
arms.
not have been comfortable.
No. So, yeah, so I'm going to go for the Twopenny Hangover.
Okay, good choice. Good choice.
Thank you. I was also tempted to go for the Billy.
The Billy Sweet.
Billy Suite, yes, because I didn't know about that, and I think that says so much about, how poor it was in the area that they just didn't even care about the buildings and the foundations where people lived. But I'm going to go for the Twopenny Hangover.
Fabulous. All right, those are your picks this week, gang. Check on
Great.
Instagram for those options.
The Wheel of Destiny.
Wheel of Destiny time. What's happening?
Well, I'm ready. You ready?
Crack on.
Oh,
it's landed. I put this on ages ago. I know what I wanted to talk about in this area, but it's never landed here. It's Euston.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, I know straight away.
Oh, can I guess? I bet I know what it's going to be.
Oh yeah, it's probably quite obvious, isn't it?
The Welcome Collection.
Yes.
Yay!
So, I love the Welcome Collection.
Goth guy can't make a comeback.
Weird and crazy, absurd things that you see in there that just kind of stay with you. But I'm going to talk about Henry Welcome himself, and okay. I'm going to talk about the birth of the tablet, the paracetamol.
The iPad.
No, darling. The medication.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, about the collection itself, and yeah, about a bit about medicine.
Fantastic.
Cool.
Amazing. Well, that's for next week.
That's for next week.
Thank you all for coming this week. We really appreciate you being here.
We really do.
Please go and leave us a review. I don't think anyone's left any reviews for a while. If you can't be bothered to leave a review, leave one anyway. It's the law.
It's the law.
Go and leave it. And please make it nice. We are humans after all. If you don't like us, just don't say anything.
Please don't. We can't take it anymore.
We genuinely can't take it. It's ruining our souls. But otherwise, we will see you next week for a little bit of chat about some medicinal stuff.
Cool. Can't wait.
See you then.
Bye. Have a good week, people. Bye.